Did you know Microsoft has officially ended support for Windows 10? Upgrade to Windows 11 with an LG Gram laptop. Voted PC Mag's Reader's Choice Top Laptop Brand for 2025. Thin and ultra lightweight, the LG Gram keeps you productive anywhere. And Windows 11 gives you access to free security updates and ongoing feature upgrades. Visit lgusa.com/iHeart for great seasonal savings on LG Gram laptops with Windows 11. PC Mag Reader's Choice used with permission. All rights reserved.
The man known to history as the Supreme Allied Commander, the hero of D-Day, and the 34th President of the United States, Dwight David Eisenhower, was born on the 14th of October 1890 in Denison, Texas. The third of seven boys, Dwight acquired his more well-known nickname of Ike from his parents, who meant it to be a diminutive of their last name. Interestingly, all of the Eisenhower boys were called some variation of Ike when they were children, but only Dwight retained the nickname into his adulthood. His modest working-class upbringing and early educational career gave little hint of the grand accomplishments he would achieve in the coming decades. Eisenhower was descended from German, English, and Scottish immigrants to North America. His paternal ancestors had been German Protestant farmers who had emigrated to Pennsylvania during the 1740s. A branch of this family moved to Kansas during the 19th century, and there, at Lane University, David Eisenhower met his future wife, Ida Stover. The two were married in the autumn of 1885 and settled in the town of Hope, Kansas. The Eisenhowers opened a general store in Hope, and Ida gave birth to their first son, Arthur, the following year. Unfortunately, the family business failed, not only because of the economic downturn in American farming communities, but also due to the dishonest behavior and dealings of David's business partners. Now facing much poorer circumstances, the family was forced to relocate to Texas. Using his college education as an engineer, David secured employment on the Missouri-Texas-Kansas Railroad for a monthly wage of $40. The family rented a small house in Denison and began a slow financial recovery. During their few years in Texas, two more Eisenhower sons were born, Edgar and Dwight. In 1892, the family returned to Kansas, settling in Abilene. That year, Ida gave birth to the family's fourth son, Roy, and David became a mechanic for the Bell Springs Creamery, typically working 12-hour shifts, 6 days per week, and now earning $50 per month. The Eisenhowers thereafter put down their roots in Abilene, and Dwight always considered it his real hometown, despite having been born in Texas. David and Ida raised their six boisterous and competitive sons in a modest 800-square-foot house on the wrong side of the tracks in Abilene, but with enough land on their property to grow a few subsistence crops and keep a few animals. Combined with David's salary, the Eisenhower family were able to support themselves well enough. Dwight later reflected on his mostly happy childhood. "I never knew we were poor," he said. The values stressed at home were typical of the ethical culture of people of the American Plains regions: responsibility, hard work, faith, humility, modesty, honesty, and sincerity. In addition to their regular chores, each of the boys was assigned a plot of the family's property to cultivate crops, and each boy was responsible for selling the crops he produced to help support the family. David responded to any and all misbehavior on the part of his sons with firm discipline. Ike, more than occasionally, found himself in trouble for his hot and quick temper, which often landed him in fights with other boys in and out of school. Religion played an important role in the Eisenhowers' family life. David and Ida were members of the Mennonite sect, called the Brethren of Christ, also known as the River Brethren, for their practice of baptizing their followers in rivers. A religious shift took place in the Eisenhower house in the spring of 1895, when the whole family fell into deep mourning. The family's fifth son, Paul, died of diphtheria at only 10 months old. As often happens in response to tragedy, Ida's faith seems to have undergone an alteration following her son's death. Some months earlier, Ida had begun attending meetings of the International Bible Students Association, an organization that would later become known as the Jehovah's Witnesses. Following her son's death, Ida's association with this sect became more pronounced, and the Abilene chapter of this group began holding meetings regularly at the Eisenhower home. David and Ida encouraged their children in their religious education and observance, holding daily Bible study sessions as a family. Both David and Ida were pacifists, and Ida focused much attention on Dwight's religious development in an attempt to temper his fascination with the historical wars and struggles he so enjoyed reading about.
Did you know Microsoft has officially ended support for Windows 10? Upgrade to Windows 11 with an LG Gram laptop. Voted PC Mag's Reader's Choice Top Laptop Brand for 2025. Thin and ultra lightweight, the LG Gram keeps you productive anywhere. And Windows 11 gives you access to free security updates and ongoing feature upgrades. Visit lgusa.com/iHeart for great seasonal savings on LG Gram laptops with Windows 11. PC Mag Reader's Choice used with permission. All rights reserved.
By the time Dwight left home for college, he had read the entire Bible twice. Predictably, his command of scripture remained formidable throughout his life. Yet while religion figured centrally in his childhood, Ike never actually joined a church himself. He never seemed to favor any particular Christian denomination either, though he had connections to the Presbyterian Church through his wife, Mamie. He described himself as a deeply religious man, but his religious sensibilities largely remained a private matter for him. Some historians speculate that this reticence to speak about religion might have been connected to his mother's religious affiliation. Some speculate that the Eisenhower sons, particularly Dwight, might have wanted to keep public discussion of their mother's religious practices muted for public relations purposes. The Jehovah's Witnesses were considered to be a rather radical fringe sect of millenarianism for much of the 20th century, and it is possible that the Eisenhower siblings, who all achieved and enjoyed impressive careers in law, banking, academia, engineering, healthcare, and the military, were keen to protect their family's reputation. Even John F. Kennedy, Eisenhower's presidential successor, was considered a controversial candidate for political office because of his Catholicism. In fact, America's current president, Joe Biden, is only the second Catholic and also only the second non-Protestant to hold the office of President of the United States. Abilene was typical of small-town America, a small city surrounded by a vast rural expanse. The Eisenhower children were therefore exposed to both city and country modes of life, although the rural experience was undoubtedly more familiar to them. Young Dwight developed a keen interest in the outdoors, particularly in hunting and fishing. At this particular time and place in America, life was tough for non-professionals and the working class, but most people firmly believed that hard work and honest dealings could eventually produce success, no matter where one started. Moreover, it was easier to achieve a modestly genteel prosperity in a town like Abilene than in a major urban or commercial center. Perhaps this sense of possibility and opportunity was part of the key to Ike's later confidence and success. For most of his early education, Ike was a fairly average student. He enjoyed his spelling and arithmetic lessons and became a voracious reader early in life. His mother Ida, a former teacher, had a decent collection of history books, and once Ike began reading them, history quickly became one of his favorite subjects, particularly military history. He pored over the military exploits of his favorite historical generals, including Hannibal and, predictably, George Washington. As a highly active and athletic boy, however, Ike was far more interested in football than anything else in his early academic career. The sheer physicality of the sport likely provided an outlet for Dwight's excessive energy and often quick temper. His love of the game and his desire to keep playing even caused him to risk his life at the age of 14. Ike had sustained a leg injury which led to a serious infection, for which his doctor recommended a leg amputation. Ike implored his parents to respect his decision to forego the amputation, even if the infection killed him. He preferred to take a chance that he might get better and retain the use of his legs. This would not be the first time that luck was demonstrably with him, and Ike made a full recovery, going on to play football in high school and college. Throughout his educational career, he continued to demonstrate fairly average academic performance overall, but retained his interest in history and reading. Western novels were a particular favourite of Ike's. He also showed an aptitude and interest in the practical applications of maths and sciences, which is unsurprising for the son of a college-educated engineer, as well as a man whose admirers would come to consider as a strategic and organizational genius. Ike's strategic thinking also manifested itself in his skill at card playing, a pursuit he continued to enjoy and to get better at throughout his life, particularly poker and bridge. His high school contemporaries predicted that Ike would enjoy a successful career as an Ivy League history professor. However, financial circumstances and personal inclinations guided Eisenhower in a vastly different direction. Dwight and his older brother Edgar graduated from Abilene High School together in 1909. Both wanted to go to college, but the family's income at the time was insufficient to pay tuition for two sons at once. Dwight and Edgar therefore agreed that Edgar would attend college first, while Dwight went to work at the creamery where their father worked. In this way, Dwight would help finance his brother's education, with the understanding that after Edgar graduated, he would do the same for Dwight. He spent more than a year working 6 days a week for a wage of $3 at the creamery. It was soon suggested to him that entering a military academy could secure him a tuition-free college education. Ike's long love affair with military history and his active, sometimes temperamental personality as a young man made him an ideal fit for such an institution. It would teach him structure, self-control, and the value of cooperation, all of which would be crucial to his later military and political roles. In 1911, with decent test scores and a recommendation from his congressman, Eisenhower was admitted to West Point Military Academy in New York. Eisenhower's college career was formative, and the experience he had there taught him much about the value of organization and calm, competent leadership. He started out less interested in becoming a military career man than in simply obtaining a college education and getting to play football at the same time. During his freshman year, Eisenhower even got the chance to confront the legendary Native American football player and Olympic gold medalist Jim Thorpe in the 1912 game between West Point and the Carlisle Institute, a Native American trade school, seeking the glory of victory over the team who boasted America's foremost athlete at the time. Ike and several of his teammates focused their offensive on Thorpe in particular, hoping to bolster their team's advantage by taking him out of the game. Thorpe persevered through the onslaught, however, and Carlisle won the game. But this historic match was to be Eisenhower's last. He badly injured his knee following the game with resulting permanent damage. Being no longer able to play football was a significant loss for Ike, but by his second year at West Point, he was coaching the junior varsity team and continued in this role until graduation. It is likely that coaching helped to foster the general in him rather than the soldier and brought out the calm, competent, supportive, strategic, and organized side of him rather than the brash, impulsive, and sometimes aggressive side. Beyond his admittedly fulfilling role as football coach, Ike continued to be a decent, though not an excellent, student. He took mostly science and technology courses, graduating 61st in a class of 164 students. He finished 10th in his class, however, in English and history, and was much admired for his eloquent writing. He had made the best of a college career which had largely not included playing football, a reality which had embittered him for a time. Ike began to smoke heavily by his second year at West Point and enjoyed as many poker games as he could, both prohibited activities at the academy. While his academic record was merely average, his discipline record was even less impressive, and he ranked 125th in discipline in a class of 164 students. Still, Eisenhower made lifelong friends in college and formed relationships that would one day figure in international importance. Many of the young men with whom he attended college would be tapped for high military command by the beginning of World War II. Popularly dubbed the class the stars fell on, no less than 59 graduates, roughly a third of West Point's class of 1915, went on to become generals, including two five-star generals, Eisenhower himself and Omar Bradley. Ike's life shifted significantly after graduation, and within a year, his future military career had begun to take shape just as he met and fell in love with his future wife. Ike opted for the infantry after graduating from West Point and was posted to Fort Sam Houston near San Antonio, Texas. He was introduced to Mary Dowd, known as Mamie, soon after his arrival on the base. Mamie was the pretty, charming, and vivacious daughter of a wealthy family from Denver, Colorado. The Dowds owned a lucrative meatpacking company and spent the winters in Texas. "He was just about the handsomest man I'd ever seen," Mamie later wrote about the fair-haired, blue-eyed man who would become her husband. Ike proposed to Mamie on Valentine's Day in 1916, and the two were married that July. Their first son, who they named Dowd, adorably nicknamed Ikey, was born the following year. Despite attempts to be posted overseas in a more active role, Eisenhower spent most of the next few years in junior officer training, coaching football for Peacock Military Academy and St. Louis College, training units and regiments, or serving in supply and logistics roles. His emerging organizational, administrative, and leadership qualities served him well through the First World War years, although he was repeatedly denied the opportunity to see any real military action. Eisenhower learned a great deal during this period, however, forming opinions about how the military of the future should be developed, both strategically and technologically. Like many other career military men of his day, Eisenhower saw the value of developing tanks and firepower rather than infantry offensives. He trained tank regiments in Georgia in 1917 and in Pennsylvania in 1918. In 1919, after being posted to Camp Meade, he helped orchestrate a transcontinental vehicle convoy from Washington, D.C. to San Francisco, which taught him a great deal about tank and truck capabilities depending on terrain. This massive effort, involving hundreds of men and over 80 vehicles, was carried out with very little paved road to smooth the convoy's way, and there were literally dozens of breakdown events during the 3,200-mile, 62-day journey. The experience convinced him of the efficiency, productivity, and logistical benefits to be gleaned from the creation of a national highway system, which would later be a staple infrastructure program of his presidency. It wounded Ike's pride deeply that he had not been able to serve in a combat role in the war. He had finally received orders to depart for Europe with the unit he had finished training on the 18th of November 1918. However, exactly 1 week prior to the date of his departure, the armistice was announced. Ike was deeply disappointed. Conventionally, the way to establish a reputation and earn promotion in the military was through distinguished combat service, and Ike worried that his career might stagnate as a result of his never having served overseas. Yet it may have been a blessing in disguise, as few soldiers were prepared for the brutal savagery of the new, more technologically advanced warfare. The casualties were staggering, and the impact on the average soldier's mental health often debilitating. Instead, Eisenhower was lucky enough to spend the First World War years safely and contentedly with his young family and the friends he had made in the service. In 1920, Mamie and Ikey, who had been staying with her parents off and on during the previous year, rejoined Ike at Camp Meade, Pennsylvania, where they settled into their new house on the base right next door to George Patton, with whom Ike had quickly become friends. The two shared an enthusiasm for experimentation with military strategy and equipment, forming a personal and professional relationship that would continue through three decades and a world war. Tragedy struck in January 1921, however, when the three-year-old Ikey died after contracting scarlet fever. The child had caught the disease from a maid Ike and Mamie had hired, who had begun work in the Eisenhower household before she had fully recovered from her illness. Devastated, Ike and Mamie blamed themselves, and the tragedy had a profound impact on their marriage. Both grieved deeply and privately. Ike rarely spoke about his son's death, later writing, "This was the greatest disappointment and disaster in my life, the one I have never been able to forget completely." A year after Ike's passing, their second and only son, John, was born, and a sense of joy, comfort, and continuity began to return to the Eisenhower household once again. Every year, without fail, Ike sent Mamie flowers on the anniversary of Ike's death. Some of his biographers view Eisenhower's career during the interwar period as relatively stagnant, since he attained a rank no higher than lieutenant colonel prior to the beginning of World War II, when he was 51 years old. However, the 1920s and 1930s were, in fact, a highly productive learning period for Ike, when his more modern views on military development and his emerging promise as a leader, administrator, and strategist brought him to the attention of highly influential military men who mentored him and helped promote his career. Chief among them was General Fox Connor, whom Eisenhower met over dinner at George Patton's house at Camp Meade. Connor was impressed with Eisenhower, and having been appointed Army Chief of Staff by General Pershing, used his influence to have Ike appointed his executive officer in the Panama Canal Zone in 1922, where Connor commanded the 20th Infantry Brigade. Ike, Mamie, and Baby John spent the next 2 years in Panama. The Canal Zone was a rather dreary and underdeveloped area, not the most stimulating environment for a new mother or her child. Being together was important for the Eisenhowers, however, and while it strained their marriage, Ike and Mamie coped as well as they could with family life and child-rearing under the stress of constant relocation and new, sometimes uncomfortable environments, as many career military families do. Fortunately, his duties as a staff officer in Panama were relatively light, and General Connor encouraged Ike to use the extra time to read extensively on history and philosophy, particularly military history and strategy. Eisenhower learned a great deal from Connor while serving as his executive officer and came to understand that Connor took such a personal interest in him because of the general's conviction that another world war was coming. When it did, Connor knew that the Allies would need the ablest and best prepared men available to step into high command. Accordingly, as part of his tutelage, Connor shared his first World War experiences with Eisenhower, the tactics of battle, the successes and failures, the heavy decision-making involved in maintaining alliances and mobilizing men and resources. He expressed his grave concerns about the questionable soundness and potentially problematic nature of the Versailles Treaty as well. Eisenhower emerged from Connor's mentorship more confident in his perspectives and abilities, and prepared to excel more than ever before. After returning to Camp Meade in 1924, Eisenhower, thanks partly to General Connor's influence, was admitted to the Command and General Staff School at Fort Leavenworth, Kansas, where he studied Army tactics and operations and the problem-solving involved in managing them. Completion of General Staff School was necessary to rise in the Army ranks, and a curriculum was notoriously grueling. No longer simply an average student, in 1926, Ike graduated first in a class of 275. Connor intervened once again in 1927 to have Eisenhower assigned to the American Battle Monuments Commission in Washington, D.C., where he was tasked by General Pershing with writing a narrative history of the American Expeditionary Forces service in Belgium and France during World War I. Later that year, he was admitted to the Army War College in D.C., where he once again graduated first in his class in 1928. Ike and Mamie spent the next year in France, where Eisenhower was commissioned to tour and produce a guide of the First World War battle sites in France. He was then assigned to the War Department in D.C. and tasked with developing plans and strategies for industrial mobilization should another major war break out. In 1930, he met the newly appointed Army Chief of Staff, Douglas MacArthur, whom he quickly impressed with his intelligence and competence. "This is the best damn officer in the Army," MacArthur once remarked about Eisenhower, and resolved, like General Connor before him, to promote Eisenhower's career. Like Connor, MacArthur believed another war would be on the horizon, and in terms of potential military leaders, Eisenhower was one of the most promising. Ike spent the 1930s working closely with MacArthur. As his assistant in Washington, Eisenhower helped to formulate policy and mobilization strategy for a potential upcoming war, according to MacArthur's vision. And in 1935, he accompanied the general to the Philippines, where MacArthur had been assigned to serve as military advisor to President Manuel Quezon. The Philippines were in a transitional period towards independence, and U.S. authorities were anxious that the region be defended from a potential invasion, which they worried might be launched by the Japanese.
Eisenhower spent the next 4 years attempting to operationalize and implement MacArthur's plan for the Philippines' defense, one which required key regions to be reinforced using a citizen army properly trained to fight, and which could be carried out with limited support and resources from the United States. The task was daunting, and the odds of success seemed bleak, but Eisenhower dutifully pursued his assigned goals and did the best he could under the circumstances. Unfortunately, the Philippines would fall to the Japanese by 1942 anyway. What made Ike's experience in MacArthur's service much more difficult was the political infighting among the Americans stationed there and the personality clashes with MacArthur. But Ike had come a long way from being the hot-tempered young man spoiling for a fight. He had learned instead to compromise, conciliate, and negotiate. He was also noted for maintaining cordial relations with people he disagreed with, a skill he undoubtedly perfected in MacArthur's service. MacArthur was notorious for his irascible personality, and nearly a decade working with him effectively ruined all but the most professional part of the relationship between the two men. Eisenhower, however, proved to have truly mastered himself by having served so well under MacArthur. Ike's strong suit going forward would be his remarkable ability to deal diplomatically, patiently, and effectively with the many high-ranking Allied leaders and commanders, all of whom had to collaborate if they were to secure victory. And many of the Allied leaders and generals of the Second World War were famously difficult, even intolerable personalities. Churchill, de Gaulle, Stalin, Montgomery, and Patton, to name just a few, were all more than challenging to work with. And while they rarely expressed any unreserved approval of their international compatriots, virtually all had good things to say about Eisenhower, seeing him as infinitely competent, fair-minded, genuine, and trustworthy. By 1939, Ike was more than ready for a change, and he discreetly wrote to friends in Washington to help him find a new posting. He returned to Washington shortly after war was declared between Britain and Germany in September. He spent the next 2 years in multiple postings, both as a staff officer and in the field, advising and assisting in the expansion and mobilization of U.S. forces in preparation for a possible entry into World War II. He was given command of the Third Army and received acclaim and commendations for their successes against the Second Army in the 1941 War Games in Louisiana, after which he was promoted to Brigadier General. 5 days after the Japanese attack on Pearl Harbor in December 1941, Secretary of War General George Marshall summoned Eisenhower to Washington and appointed him to head the War Plans Division, eventually giving him command of all U.S. forces in the European theater. It is possible that Ike had been shuffled around in so many different postings in the 2 years leading to U.S. entry into the war because his performance in various roles was being carefully watched. Apparently, Marshall had decided that Ike was most valuable for his ability to plan, organize, and facilitate the execution of effective military policy and maneuvers. As Secretary of War, Marshall could not afford to promote men who would need to be micromanaged. Marshall needed eminently competent, responsible, accountable generals to whom he could delegate charge of the various large-scale operations and who would act confidently and independently in the moment when necessary. With his 2+ decades of experience, Eisenhower fitted the bill perfectly. Yet he now had a greater task before him than he had ever faced, and with little notion of just how great his challenges would be by the last months of the European theater. Eisenhower departed for London in June of 1942. Ike arrived in England with his work cut out for him. Not only nationalistic rivalry, but also unease and distrust clouded the interactions between the Allied military and political leaders. This made planning and cooperation challenging, but communicating effectively with prickly personalities and encouraging many conflicting elements to work together was Eisenhower's strong suit. He was given command of the Allied invasion of North Africa, launched in November of 1942. Accompanying Ike to North Africa was a pretty 33-year-old Irish divorcee named Kay Summersby. She had been assigned to Eisenhower as a driver after his arrival in London, and she remained with him as his personal secretary for the duration of the war. The nature of the relationship between Eisenhower and Summersby has been the subject of much historical controversy and debate. Away from the front, World War II was a very flirtatious time, and numerous members of the American military, both young privates and great generals, formed romantic relationships with British women. Ike and Kay clearly liked each other a great deal, but the exact nature of their relationship has never been fully clarified. Rumors abounded that they were having an affair and that Eisenhower would seek a divorce. However, Ike gave no sign of any such thing in the more than 300 letters he wrote to his wife Mamie while he was overseas. After Eisenhower's death, Kay published a memoir in which it was claimed that while there was a romance between them, they had never slept together. Whatever the truth of their relationship, Ike cut ties with Kay when the war was over, returning home to his wife and son. Eisenhower's first major challenge in the Second World War was the North African theater, and while the operation was ultimately a success, it was also plagued by missed opportunities, logistics problems, and painful mistakes. Ike ruefully observed that students at the General Staff College in Washington would be criticizing American performance in North Africa for decades to come. However, the general learned important lessons during the campaign, which he would carry forward with him through subsequent challenges. Operation Torch was the largest amphibious invasion in military history up until that time, and pitted General Eisenhower against the Desert Fox, General Erwin Rommel. Rommel's forces had been struggling against the British 8th Army, led by General Montgomery, in the Western Desert Campaign. The Allies took three key ports on the northwest coast, Oran, Casablanca, and Algiers, before proceeding east toward Tunisia. The 8th Army, in turn, marched west, and by May 1943, the Tunisian campaign ended with the surrender of the Axis forces. Most were of the opinion that the North African theater of operations had continued for much longer than it should have. Eisenhower had been too cautious to proceed on multiple occasions and had not dealt decisively enough with personnel issues or supply problems. Although the Allies took over 250,000 German prisoners of war and were left in command of the field, Rommel and the bulk of his German forces had escaped. Eisenhower would confront the Desert Fox again, next time on the Western Front. One of Ike's greatest strengths was his ability to learn from his mistakes. Going forward, he resolved to act more decisively and to fine-tune all logistical and personnel relationships. He got tougher on himself, as well as on the men serving under him, who nonetheless thought highly of him. Ike was not the inspirational sort of general. Many of the most admired generals were highly charismatic, temperamental men who inspired gut-level loyalty for their abilities, but often had near intolerable personalities and diva-like attitudes. Eisenhower had famously had to interfere in a disciplinary scandal to keep the near indispensable Patton from a court-martial after the abrasive general, disgusted at their shows of emotion, had physically assaulted two shell-shocked soldiers. Ike was not a fiery, charismatic sort, but he was admired for being plain-spoken, respectful, compassionate, and a conciliator who never tried to dodge responsibility when the failure was his. His troops may not have viewed him in the same worshipful light as generals like Patton or Montgomery, but they knew that General Eisenhower cared about them. The kind of diva squabbling which Eisenhower notably avoided as a general actually impeded the progress of Operation Husky, when Patton and Montgomery seemed more interested in competing with one another in an absurdly nationalistic display during the invasion of Sicily, rather than cooperating in a swift takeover of the island so that they could press the Allied advantage. Their respective armies competed in a race to take Messina. Meanwhile, the Axis powers managed to evacuate 100,000 men, 10,000 vehicles, and 17,000 tons of supplies with which to reinforce and defend the Italian mainland. The Allies would thus quite literally face an uphill battle, all the way up the Italian boot, to secure victory. In fact, the fascists in Italy held out even after the fall of Berlin in 1945, as the war was coming to an end. In December 1943, President Franklin Roosevelt selected Eisenhower to plan and orchestrate the invasion of Western Europe, codenamed Operation Overlord, on what has become known popularly as D-Day. For most historians and general admirers of Eisenhower, this was his magnum opus, his greatest achievement. Knowing that 60 German divisions commanded by his old foe Rommel were waiting for him, Eisenhower assiduously planned and organized these last stages of the war's long struggle, trying to provide for every eventuality and implementing lessons he had learned about collaboration, delegation, strategy, logistics, and maneuvers during his 30-year military career.
And now from our sponsor, Call of War, the cross-platform, real-time grand strategy game in which you choose a real country to lead during World War II. Simply click the Call of War link in the video description to start playing today. Take command of your own nation, build up your resources, and equip your army ready to fight up to 100 other players. Expand and defend your country over weeks of multiplayer gameplay using historic maps and varying scenarios, moving in real time over different terrains. Develop your secret weapons to control the battlefield and become a war hero in the process. Defend your country by building alliances. Choose your own strategy and perfect your own technological strategy to win the war. You get an exclusive gift. Click on the link in the description to get 13,000 gold and 1 month of premium subscription for free. Offer only available for 30 days. Don't lose time. Play this sensational strategy game of life and death on the battlefield. Try out Call of War for free now.
The Germans knew that the Allies would attack Western Europe via the English Channel, but they did not know exactly where or when the attack would come. Having learned the importance of preserving the element of surprise from the North African and Italian campaigns, Eisenhower determined to cripple Axis supply lines in a preliminary bombing campaign before invading France. To keep the Germans guessing as to his real strategy, Eisenhower planned two other fake invasions at alternate locations on the French coast to keep the Germans away from the site where the Allies planned to strike. These mock invasions even featured inflatable tanks and parachuting dummies, which kept the far-flung German divisions along the Atlantic Wall confused for weeks after the initial landings while the Allied invasion continued. The deception campaign was truly elaborate. The Allies airdropped thin strips of metal to interfere with German radar communications. They created fake radio and code traffic, which they allowed the enemy to intercept. And they sent in double agents to pose as Axis spies, who fed the enemy erroneous intelligence about Allied plans and movements. Still the largest amphibious invasion in military history, the D-Day landings involved 156,000 Allied troops from the British, American, and Canadian forces, who established a beachhead around 10 miles deep into occupied territory. Here, Eisenhower gave Patton and his troops free rein to promptly and furiously begin to break through the German lines. In a matter of weeks, the Allies had landed 2 million more troops, tens of thousands of vehicles, and untold amounts of supplies. The westward push across Europe began. Eisenhower now had no reticence about proceeding, both decisively and aggressively, but the Germans would make one last stand, one that threatened to potentially tip the scales back in their favour, long enough for them to regroup, the Battle of the Bulge. By the fall of 1944, Hitler had quite clearly and correctly anticipated that Germany would soon be overrun and occupied. The Soviets were closing in from the east, and the rest of the Allied forces were advancing on Germany from the west. In an attempt to deal the Allies a blow deadly enough to forestall the Western invasion, the Germans launched a last, desperate counteroffensive in the Ardennes region of northern France and Belgium. Hitler's goal was to force an Allied retreat westward, to get enough divisions across the Meuse River to take Antwerp, and thereby cripple the Allied supply lines, forcing them to sign a peace with Germany. Then perhaps they might have a chance of defeating the Soviets. As things stood, the Germans could not continue fighting a multi-front war. The Battle of the Bulge was highly crucial to the war's ultimate outcome. Troops on both sides were exhausted and experiencing continuous supply problems. Both Allied and Axis leaders understood that the winners of this battle would, in all likelihood, win the war. The surprise offensive came in December of 1944. The Germans sent in 400,000 men, nearly twice as many troops as the Allies to the west, and roughly 10% more tanks. Accordingly, the Germans initially showed significant success, pushing the British and American troops back toward the west, encircling and besieging Allied-held towns, with two divisions advancing as far as a mere 5 miles from the Meuse River. This early success was partly attributable to the winter weather conditions in the region, which prevented Allied air power from providing support. But once the weather lifted in January, American and British planes took to the skies once again and devastated the German supply lines. What was left of the German Air Force spent itself trying to destroy the Allied supply lines as well. But it was too late. In desperation, the German Panzer divisions flung themselves at the enemy, hoping for a victory before remaining supplies collapsed. General Eisenhower, however, orchestrated a brilliant and valiant defense in key locations in the Ardennes region, and the Allies held out until the Germans were forced to retreat. They had suffered nearly as many casualties as the Allies. The war appeared to be all but over, bar the mopping up. Most historians and history buffs will immediately point to D-Day as Eisenhower's greatest achievement, which is hard to argue. There was, after all, something almost supernatural about the level of intricacy involved in the venture. The Bulge, however, was Eisenhower's only real test as a field commander on the ground. The glory he had sought and been denied by being kept stateside during the First World War was now his to claim, and in a moment when it truly counted. Consequently, some historians see the Battle of the Bulge as an achievement that was as significant for Eisenhower as the execution of the D-Day landings. Following the German surrender, Eisenhower remained in Europe to help oversee the Allied occupation and to organize the investigation and documentation necessary for the Nuremberg trials. According to American policy, which viewed most of the German people as victims of the Nazi regime, Eisenhower made efforts to ensure an adequate supply of food to support the local populace and labor to help repair necessary infrastructure. He also placed a heavy emphasis on the thorough documentation of the death camps, commissioning extensive photographic and video evidence, and not just to serve as evidence for the Nuremberg trials. The grisly and haunting spectacle of the camps had utterly horrified Eisenhower. What had taken place in these facilities was so hideous as to be almost unbelievable, and he correctly anticipated that, in future, propagandists might use people's unwillingness to believe that such extreme crimes were possible in order to deny the reality of the Holocaust. Eisenhower finally returned home in the summer of 1945 to a hero's welcome. With the recent death of President Roosevelt prior to the end of the war, Ike was now the most popular man in America, and many influential friends were urging him to enter the presidential race for the 1948 election, including President Truman himself, who even offered to serve as Ike's running mate if Eisenhower joined the Democrats. The fact of his high military office and lack of political experience, however, made him wary of entering the race, believing it might hint at military dictatorship. Additionally, the prospect of political office seemed daunting to a 56-year-old man who might prefer a less demanding occupation after his wartime exertions. Instead, Eisenhower was offered the position of president at the prestigious Columbia University, which he gladly accepted in 1948. Later that year, he published his World War II memoir, Crusade in Europe, which was an immediate bestseller. For the first time in his life, Eisenhower was a man of means. Ike had mixed experiences during his 2 years at Columbia. He founded the Institute of War and Peace Studies to research the causes and consequences of armed conflict. He also established an informal council on foreign relations to deliberate on important foreign policy initiatives. The opportunities for meaningful interaction with political, military, and intellectual leaders, therefore, made Ike's time at Columbia a rich experience in many ways. However, he did not get as many opportunities to participate in the formulation of educational policy or to engage directly with the students and faculty as much as he wished. Moreover, the academic establishment at the university sometimes made him feel less than welcome. Some members of the tenured faculty tended to look down their noses at Eisenhower for what they perceived as his rusticity, his lack of sophistication, such as his literary preference for dime store Western novels. As well as this, his relative lack of involvement in the daily educational life of the university stoked some resentment towards him as university president. In 1950, he resigned his post at Columbia and departed once again for Europe, this time serving as the supreme commander of the NATO alliance. Eisenhower spent the next year advising America's European allies and helping to build a broad and powerful military coalition which could stand against the rising forces of communism, provide a bulwark to defend democracies, and present enough united force to discourage the outbreak of future wars. Upon his return to the US in 1951, he made an eloquent appeal to Congress, convincing the typically isolationist legislative body to offer firm support for the NATO alliance. With unprecedented grassroots support for an Eisenhower presidency growing across the country, President Truman once again approached Eisenhower, offering to support his candidacy as a Democrat.
Eisenhower, who had never voted or publicly aired any political opinion or affiliation up until this time, declined, finally declaring himself to be a Republican. This was the beginning of a permanent and bitter rift between Truman and Eisenhower, which only worsened through the 1952 election campaign season. Ike's political declaration inspired a draft Eisenhower movement in the Republican Party. Understanding that his opponent for the party nomination, Robert A. Taft, had far less concern for foreign than for domestic policy, and that all of his work for international security might be at risk in a more isolationist America, Ike finally decided to throw his hat into the ring. "I like Ike" buttons were suddenly everywhere, and enthusiastic voters could be heard humming the unavoidably catchy television jingle, also called "I Like Ike," under their breath. Ike's campaign was notably populist in its character, which is odd since Eisenhower himself was nothing of the sort, and if left to his own devices, likely would have campaigned simply on his established record of sober, calm, competent leadership and administration. He achieved an impressive victory over the Democratic candidate Adlai Stevenson in November of 1952, winning the votes from every state in the Electoral College except for the South, and winning 55% of the popular vote. He would repeat this success even more impressively in the election of 1956, achieving a landslide victory over Stevenson a second time. While he was one of the oldest presidents elected in many decades, Ike continued to be an active man. As president, he was committed and hardworking, while still knowing how to delegate. And he continued to pursue his hobbies and interests, including his reading, his poker, and bridge games, attending baseball and football games, and a rather more recently acquired passion, landscape painting, which he was surprised to find he was rather good at. Eisenhower's two-term presidency featured massive economic growth, social change, and increasing international tension. Ike is generally thought of as a president more concerned with foreign policy than domestic, and he certainly gave top priority to unfolding events in the Cold War world. However, his reticence to encroach on constitutional conventions such as the self-determination of states and the separation of powers has been interpreted by some as a lack of concern for serious social issues, particularly civil rights. Eisenhower had insisted on campaigning in the segregationist South, trying to win both white and black voters. He refused to condemn the segregationists outright, but promptly implemented the full desegregation of Washington, D.C., all U.S. armed forces, and the Foreign Service. He encouraged increased recruitment of African Americans to government positions, and privately deplored the attempts of white supremacists to keep black people from voting. Hearing about the attacks on black Americans who achieved economic success in the South infuriated him, but he would not take a more activist role in the cause of civil rights or anti-racism. This deeply disappointed many black voters and civil rights leaders, particularly when Eisenhower refused to comment publicly on the brutal and racially motivated murder of 14-year-old Emmett Till in Mississippi in 1955, or the bombing of Dr. Martin Luther King's house the following year. Several subsequent presidents have been far more outspoken about racist extremism and hate crimes, and been more openly supportive of civil rights. The way Ike saw it, bold action on civil rights might produce immediate change, but might also prove destabilizing if change occurred too quickly. He also did not believe that he could, as president, usurp the legislative prerogatives of Congress. He could dismantle the structural racism of segregation within the federal jurisdiction, but it was up to Congress to pass comprehensive civil rights legislation, a Congress which the Republicans had lost once again to the Democrats in 1954, and which they had held by only the slimmest margins to begin with. Eisenhower could, however, appoint Supreme Court justices with civil rights leanings, and accordingly appointed two of them to the bench, including Chief Justice Earl Warren, whose judicial opinion in the Brown v. Board of Education case finally struck down the segregationist Plessy v. Ferguson. Further, Eisenhower did not hesitate to enforce the Brown decision in the South when they refused to cooperate and allow school desegregation to go forward. He assumed control of the Arkansas National Guard to force the racial integration of Little Rock High School in 1957. Previously, Eisenhower had quietly negotiated with the Arkansas governor, Orville Forbes, to ensure that the integration would go ahead peacefully, and was infuriated when the governor went back on his word. National Guard troops remained on the Little Rock High School campus for several weeks, escorting the 9 black students safely to and from their classes in an overwhelming and often hostile sea of white students. Eisenhower's civil rights record also received criticism for his continued implementation of Native American assimilationist policies. Native American leaders charged that the Eisenhower administration's Indian policy to remove Native Americans from federal jurisdiction and abolish the reservation system threatened their culture and way of life. They accused Washington of continuing to abuse centuries-old treaty agreements and force all tribes, who each saw themselves as distinct nations, to become Americans, which previous administrations had been trying to do for decades. Eisenhower was also criticized for his failure to condemn the blatantly unconstitutional attacks on people suspected of communist ties during the Red Scare campaign of Senator Joseph McCarthy. Those who suffered under Joseph McCarthy's witch hunt among federal government employees likewise criticized Eisenhower for failing to openly condemn McCarthy for his unconstitutional attacks on privacy and free speech. Anyone with any documented communist leanings was targeted, but so too were civil rights activists, whom many authorities associated with a sympathy for communism. The gay and lesbian community were also targeted in these attacks, not for their political affiliation, but because their so-called lack of moral fiber left them open to blackmail by communist spies, making them untrustworthy. This mass firing of gay and lesbian employees from government positions is remembered as the Lavender Scare and was instrumental in awakening a nascent gay liberation movement, which found much louder expression by the late 1960s. While Eisenhower loathed McCarthy personally, he made no move to curtail his campaign against domestic communism, except when McCarthy attempted to start issuing congressional subpoenas to White House staff members. In response, Eisenhower was the first president to both invoke and fully define the principle of executive privilege. As far as Ike was concerned, overall political stability and national security were best served by keeping certain access to the executive branch on a privileged basis, especially from someone as ruthless, dishonest, and opportunistic as McCarthy. As president, Eisenhower is most frequently praised for presiding over one of the largest economic expansions in American history and helping the nation achieve some of the world's best quality of life outcomes. The American automobile, construction, retail, and service industries all exploded in the aftermath of World War II. Unemployment levels reached historic lows. An unprecedented number of American families bought cars, homes, and numerous other consumer goods, and began to take annual vacations. American productivity and job creation owed much to World War II. Industries continued to benefit from infrastructure built during the war, such as the automobile industry. Democratic Party members claimed that their New Deal programs and GI Bill, which Ike had no hand in, were key factors in America's healthy post-war economy. There is truth in these claims. Ike did not pioneer the farming subsidy programs, the Social Security Administration, or the infrastructure to promote fair labor practices. He was not responsible for the GI Bill, which helped former soldiers and their families reach the economic equilibrium necessary to participate in the booming economy. However, Eisenhower did work to help facilitate the economic expansion in multiple ways. He disentangled private industries from government finances, many of whom had become accustomed to receiving hefty government paychecks during the war for producing whatever was needed for the war effort. He also allowed tax rates for top earners, capital gains, and the wealthiest estates to remain high, a decidedly unconservative decision, which brought him into conflict with members of his own party. A surplus of tax revenue allowed him to expand Social Security programs to benefit an additional 10 million American workers, providing them with access to unemployment, insurance, and pensions. Ike had never been the New Deal's biggest fan, particularly in his younger years. In fact, it was his exposure to Roosevelt's administration in Washington during the 1930s which hardened his largely conservative outlook. But by the 1950s, he was under no illusions about the benefits of the basic social welfare state. Any political party who tried to get rid of the New Deal programs now, he said, would never be heard from again. He described those who still aimed to deconstruct the New Deal as a negligible and stupid splinter group. Finally, one of Eisenhower's most significant contributions to America's economic expansion was his pioneering of the Interstate Highway Act of 1956. Originally envisioned as a quick evacuation solution from densely populated urban areas in the event of a nuclear attack, the creation of the nationwide highway system opened up national markets for trade and shipping, put small towns on the map, allowing them to grow, encouraged interstate leisure travel, and facilitated the creation of businesses to serve all highway travelers. Eisenhower's America enjoyed the world's highest standard of living during the 1950s. When it came to foreign policy, Ike faced the daunting task of representing America on the world stage at the dawn of the nuclear era. His perspectives on both communism and nuclear weapons had evolved since the end of World War II. Ike had been in Russia when the atomic bomb was dropped on Hiroshima. He had been horrified, believing it had done more harm than good. The Japanese, he thought, had been close enough to surrender to make the use of the atomic bomb unnecessary, although some historians continue to disagree on this point. He found it repugnant that the United States had been the first to use nuclear weapons. He was also of the opinion that the atomic bomb had done more than anything to make the Soviets distrust the Americans, leading to increasing tensions in the years ahead. Eisenhower was still hopeful during the immediate post-war period, believing that Russia wanted friendship more than competition with the United States. By 1948, however, the Russians had tested their first atomic bomb, and tensions over Germany's economic recovery and Greece's civil war had risen considerably. The Soviets seemed bent on expansion, and Ike's stance on communism therefore hardened. He began to believe, as his Republican contemporaries did, that an overall policy of containment, backed by the threat of military action or nuclear strike, was the best path to secure American interests and continued world peace. Impressions of Eisenhower's handling of the Cold War continue to vary. Modern critics mostly condemn the activities of the CIA, which Eisenhower approved during his administration, including the overthrow of elected governments in Iran and Guatemala, charging that these operations had less to do with containing communism than installing governments more friendly to U.S. economic interests. These actions made Iranian oil accessible to U.S. and British companies and prevented the nationalization and equitable distribution of land among Guatemalans to facilitate the dominance of large-scale, corporate, American agricultural interests in the region. Containment of communism in Latin America and the Middle East continued to be a feature of American foreign policy in the years to come. The Eisenhower Doctrine, which offered military support to Middle Eastern countries determined to resist Soviet communism, profoundly affected the stability and geopolitics of the Middle East region during Eisenhower's presidency. He was praised for his contribution to solving the Suez Crisis in Egypt, but overall, American policy in the Middle East has frequently been criticized for being at cross purposes with Arab countries, who viewed Zionist imperialism as a far greater threat than communism, and who deeply resented American and British support for Israel. In principle, Eisenhower was more in favor of liberating communist countries than in containing them, but he understood that one could not constantly go to war in this new age of warfare. This is evident in his handling of the Korean War, his subsequent strategy of nuclear brinkmanship with communist China, and his policy in Southeast Asia. The death of Stalin greatly facilitated the resolution of the Korean War, as it left a temporary power vacuum which rendered China more vulnerable to US military threats, which Eisenhower did not hesitate to employ to force China to withdraw from the Korean Peninsula. Subsequently, Eisenhower was instrumental in formulating the US policy of support for Taiwan against encroachments by Red China. Unwilling to commit more than funding and military advisers to the defense of French Indochina, later South Vietnam, Eisenhower's initially minimal commitment to defeating communism in Vietnam would eventually snowball, under the subsequent Kennedy and Johnson administrations, into an arduous and undeclared war that would take the lives of 50,000 Americans and millions of Vietnamese troops and civilians. Kennedy also inherited the task of executing the Bay of Pigs invasion, planned by the Eisenhower administration, which spiraled into the Cuban Missile Crisis in 1962. Because Ike's foreign policy discouraged the pursuit of all-out war, his strategy for dealing with an expansion of Soviet influence and nuclear capability involved intricate negotiation and the building and maintenance of America's own nuclear arsenal and capabilities. admirers of Eisenhower praise his efforts at nuclear disarmament, however unsuccessful they may have proven to be. When the Soviets exploded their first hydrogen bomb, Eisenhower went against the advice of his cabinet to propose mutual nuclear disarmament with the Soviets. The campaign was called Atoms for Peace and suggested that the two superpowers might agree to decommission their weapons, using them instead to create nuclear power plants for the benefit of both countries. Ike consistently tried to avoid the one-upmanship of the arms race with the Soviets, but also did not hesitate to enlarge the US nuclear stockpile as the Russian arsenal increased. Eisenhower's open skies policy and proposed mutual inspections were also met with Russian refusal. Ultimately, neither side was willing to be the first to establish real trust by disarming first, or by being the first to permit UN-supervised nuclear inspections. The Eisenhower administration was significantly embarrassed by the U-2 incident, when they approved one last illegal and covert surveillance flight of the Soviet Union prior to a summit with the Russians. Khrushchev promptly produced the pilot, Francis Gary Powers, whose plane had been shot down over Soviet airspace, and who confirmed that Eisenhower had lied when he denied the existence of the U-2 flight. Furious at Ike's unabashed refusal to apologize for the incident, Khrushchev promptly cancelled the summit and rescinded Eisenhower's invitation to visit the Soviet Union. Throughout his presidency, Eisenhower grew to resent the absurdly high price tag for America's foreign policy. He had massively defunded America's conventional military forces and poured money into the development of a nuclear strategy which paradoxically kept Americans safe using the principle of assured mutual destruction. The space race eventually came to seem excessive to him as well, and Ike referred to any administration that could spend $40 billion on a race to the moon as nuts. Ike reached the end of his presidency, concerned above all about what he referred to as the military-industrial complex and its potential to hijack and erode American democracy. He had tried hard to end the excessive allocation of government and military funding to private companies after World War II, but in the thick of the arms race with the Soviets, he had not been able to prevent weapons manufacturers, who grew more powerful every year, from claiming an increasingly enormous share of American tax money for the weapons they produced. When his presidency was over, Eisenhower handed the reins of government to Kennedy, who had emerged victorious against Richard Nixon, Eisenhower's vice president in the 1960 election. Accompanied by Secret Service detail, Ike and Mamie departed the White House for their farm in Gettysburg, Pennsylvania. Ike's retirement was both pleasant and fairly active. It meant much more time with Mamie and their son John and their grandchildren. He wrote three more memoirs between 1963 and 1967 and continued his hobbies and pursuits, including poker, bridge, landscape painting, and a rather newer hobby for him, golfing. He also continued his support for Republican electoral candidates in his retirement. Eisenhower's health had begun failing as early as 1955, when he had his first heart attack. Although Vice President Nixon and Eisenhower's cabinet had done everything possible to minimize the president's health problems to the media, Ike suffered no less than four more heart attacks over the next 10 years, the last of which left him fairly debilitated, and he was permanently hospitalized by 1968. Dwight Eisenhower died of heart failure on the 28th of March 1969 at the age of 78. His coffin lay in state in the rotunda of Washington's Capitol building for several days before he was laid to rest in his beloved hometown of Abilene, Kansas, in the grounds of the Eisenhower Presidential Library and Museum. He is buried next to his wife, Mamie, and their beloved first son, Ikey. Like most other globally prominent figures of the 20th century, probably the most turbulent century of the modern period, Eisenhower has a complicated and frequently debated legacy. As one of the greatest heroes among the Allies in the Second World War, Eisenhower's contributions to victory give him indisputable historical importance and place him shoulder to shoulder with the Allies' greatest generals like Montgomery and Patton, and alongside political leaders like Churchill, Roosevelt, Stalin, and de Gaulle in terms of his influence. It is therefore interesting that while biographies of Eisenhower began to appear almost immediately following the end of World War II, and many more have been published in the decades since, Ike is, in fact, a great deal less visible in popular culture, iconography, and historical biography compared to these other prominent personages. Historians documenting his political record during the 1960s and immediately following his death were fairly critical of his presidency, particularly his silence or relative inaction on civil rights issues, or what they perceived as his limited success in preventing escalation of the Cold War. By the late 1970s and 80s, however, the conservative tide of politics had risen once again in the West, and new perspectives were offered by historians seeking to rehabilitate Eisenhower's reputation from the criticisms of earlier historians. Many of these more conservative historians attributed greater political skill to Eisenhower than he had previously been credited with. Eisenhower post-revisionists agree with this assessment, but criticize his performance as a political party leader, accusing him of failing to cultivate unity within the Republican Party or to sufficiently support Nixon in the 1960 election against Democratic candidate John F. Kennedy. This seesaw of historical perspectives continues, yet Eisenhower consistently continues to rank among the top 10 best US presidents across multiple polling sources. His greatest admirers continue to tout his presidency as a period of exceptional economic and infrastructural development, and affirm that with Ike at the tiller, the NATO alliance held, communism remained fairly well contained, and the Cold War remained cold. Some go as far as crediting Eisenhower with the prevention of a Third World War. Deeper research and examination of this fascinating man is certainly called for. Although many commentators have judged his politics as significantly right-wing, Ike himself claimed to represent, in his own words, a political philosophy of progressive conservatism, dedicated to improving productivity, efficiency, and quality of life, while maintaining both overall fiscal and political stability. This kind of blended, moderate political perspective would almost certainly enjoy dubious popularity in modern America's current atmosphere of polarization and political and cultural tribalism. Perhaps most worthy of additional study is the fascinating dual role Eisenhower played by helping to promulgate the age of hypermilitarism and nuclear weapons, sometimes wittingly and sometimes unwittingly, while simultaneously trying to forestall and or deconstruct it. The complexities of this legacy continue both to cement and to complicate international relationships today. Above all, Eisenhower's story is one which resonates strongly among those who believe in the concept of the American dream. The poor boy from rural small-town America, no more remarkable than any other boy, had become one of modern history's greatest military heroes and had twice been elected president. What do you think of Dwight D. Eisenhower? Was he a weak party leader who shied away from many important issues of his day? Or was he one of the greatest generals of the Second World War, whose leadership qualities made him a renowned and well-loved president? Please let us know in the comments below. And as always, thank you very much for watching.
Hello guys, thank you so much for watching this video. If you enjoy our work and would like to support the channel, please visit our revamped Patreon and Buy Me a Coffee membership pages, which contain rewards such as early access to our content, merchandise discounts, and audio versions of our videos, along with much more that we give to our valued supporters. If you have not yet signed up to help our cause, we'd like to ask you to please consider doing so, as we need to secure the channel by safeguarding it from possible demonetization and also invest in better equipment, software, and more people to help us improve our videos going forward. In short, without your contributions, these videos would not be possible. So if you would like to ensure this channel never has to shut down due to demonetization, please spare whatever you can per month and become People Profiles patrons. Thanks for listening.
Did you know Microsoft has officially ended support for Windows 10? Upgrade to Windows 11 with an LG Gram laptop. Voted PC Mag's Reader's Choice Top Laptop Brand for 2025. Thin and ultra lightweight, the LG Gram keeps you productive anywhere. And Windows 11 gives you access to free security updates and ongoing feature upgrades. Visit lgusa.com/iHeart for great seasonal savings on LG Gram laptops with Windows 11. PC Mag Reader's Choice used with permission. All rights reserved.